with Purim very close, I wanted to discuss this evening the mitzvah, one of the central mitzvahs of Purim, and that is the mitzvah of reading the Megillah. As we know, there are four basic mitzvahs of the day, the four mems, Mikra Megillah, Mishloach Manos, Matanis Lev Yonim, and Mishteh B'Simcha. Of these four, the Megillah is the only one that we actually make a bracha on. It's the formal Ben Adam Lamakom mitzvah in that way, as the others are more Ben Adam Lachaveiro. And although the mitzvah itself, as we say, Al Mikra Megillah, to read the Megillah, the question is, what are we doing? What are we achieving, or what are we fulfilling with the reading of the Megillah? And as we will see, there is more than one answer to this question, and a number of things combine into this event called reading the Megillah. To begin at the beginning with the most simple and straightforward understanding is that we are recounting the nes, the miracle of our survival, the miracle of our salvation. Haman, he tried to destroy us. He was very close, things being what they were. And Hashem saved us. And the reading is to tell the story in order to publicize the miracle of our salvation. And indeed, this already places the mitzvah of reading the Megillah in a very special category of mitzvahs. Megillah, of course, is Drabanan. It's not from the Torah, it's Medrabanan. But within mitzvahs Drabanan, there is a group that are the Pirsumei Nisa mitzvahs. And thus, other members of this group are Hanukkah lights on Hanukkah, also Pirsumei Nisa. And also the four cups, actually, on Seder night is also Pirsumei Nisa. Ki'ilu hu yatsa mi Mitzrayim. And there are halachic ramifications. Although generally mitzvahs d'rabbanan have a certain status and certainly lower than mitzvahs d'oraisa, but these Pirsumei Nisa mitzvos, even though they're d'rabbanan, they do require, in many respects, one to go the extra mile. Rambam says a person needs to do whatever it takes in order to fulfill these mitzvahs, and they have almost like an outsized status within the category of d'rabbanan. And therefore there is no question, and the Gemara says this explicitly, that the reading of the Megillah is Pirsumei Nisa. But as we will see, there is another accompanying or parallel element that is fulfilled through the mitzvah of reading the Megillah. And how does this come out? Where does the Megillah itself, and of course the Megillah is its own text, that is to say, one doesn't need to wonder what we say about Purim. The Megillah says it all. The mitzvahs of Mishloach Manos, Matanis Lev Yonim, and Mishteh V'Simcha, they're all mentioned explicitly in the Megillah. Where is the reading of the Megillah mentioned in the Megillah? And the answer is, although it's in a sense slighter than the others, but it's from the words in Perek Tes. All the mitzvahs of the Megillah are in Perek Tes. V'hayamim ha'ele Nizkarim v'nasim. These days are recounted and performed. Nizkarim refers to the reading of the Megillah. That's how it's recounted. And nasim are all the practical mitzvahs: Mishloach Manos, Matanis Lev Yonim, and Mishteh V'Simcha. And thus, the word which really is the anchor and the source in the Megillah for reading the Megillah is the word Nizkarim. And that becomes now of further significance because the Gemara, as we'll see quite soon, the Gemara in Maseches Megillah on Daf Zayin Omed Aleph makes a very important association between the word Nizkarim in the Megillah and the concept of Zikaron in the Torah, specifically the Zikaron of the episode with Amalek. It associates Nizkarim v'Naasim with the words at the end of Parshas B'Shalach, Kesov Zos Zikaron Basefer, and that's how we get the mitzvah of reading the Megillah. But what we see is, and it's a very important point, that the reading of the Megillah is very closely associated with remembering Amalek, and the point is, of course, that Haman himself is from Amalek. And that adds an entirely new dimension to the Megillah reading. Because essentially what it's saying is that alongside the mitzvah of publicizing the miracle of our salvation, which would be something that it would be a mitzvah to publicize regardless of who our adversary was. And in the Hanukkah story, our adversary was not Amalek, it was Yavan. And in the Pesach story, it's not Amalek, it's Paro. There is still a mitzvah to publicize the miracle of our salvation. But because our adversary in the Purim story was from Amalek, so the whole story is now also a retelling and an expansion, so to speak, of the mitzvah of remembering Amalek. After all, what is so nefarious about Amalek? What is so... why are they pitted against us? We see from the very beginning, Jewish people, they're not hurting anyone, Asher karcha baderech, we're nowhere, we're not a threat to them, but our existence is a threat to them, because what we represent is a threat to the way that they would like things to be, and they will not be happy until we are eradicated. And that was true from the very beginning. From that point of view, the Megillah is an expansion of Zohar, because it further underscores just how far this enmity goes. It doesn't go away. That means almost 1,000 years after when Amalek first attacked us and tried to destroy us completely, they were still trying. And that actually deepens an appreciation of what it is about Amalek, as the pasuk itself says, Milchama l'Hashem ba'Amalek midor dor. It's a war no less between them and Hashem, from generation to generation. And that means, as we tell the story, we're also mindful of what Haman tried to do, and in a drabbanon sense, we fulfill the mitzvah of Zohar in that way. And I wonder, I haven't seen anyone speak about this in this way, but I wonder if whether the continuation of those who would look to destroy the Jewish people 2,000 years after the Megillah story to remember them is also a further extension, because they're still going. And that's how deep the enmity runs. But in any case, we have what we could call two kiyumim, two fulfillments, two things that are being achieved through reading the Megillah. The positive, one could say, the emphasis on the fact that Hashem saved us, and the negative in the sense of remembering the enmity of Amalek's scion and descendant in the form of Haman Hagagi. And interestingly, there are halachic and practical ramifications from this idea. How so? The Gemara in Megillah on Daf Zayin Omed Aleph recounts that Esther, although Esther is a Nevi'ah and Mordechai is a Navi, they are not yet, do not have the authority between the two of them to place Megillas Esther within the Tanakh. I mean, for that you need the Sanhedrin. And she wrote a letter to the Sanhedrin asking to be put into the Tanakh. In the words of the Gemara, Shalchalahem Esther, Kisvuni Ladorus, write me down for all generations, as if to say, to be canonized within the Tanakh. And the Gemara then says that Sanhedrin deliberated upon this. Is there room in Tanakh for the story of Esther? How does it fit in? And ultimately, the inclusion of Megillas Esther within the Kisvei HaKodesh as a sefer of the 24 Svarim of Tanakh is based on that pasuk of Kesov Zos Zikaron Basefer. Write this as a remembrance in a sefer. Because the Sanhedrin then darshaned that you have three, in a sense, three openings or three slots for a description of Amalek. That pasuk was said straight after the war with Amalek. Kesov Zos, where is it written first and foremost? Well, in the Torah itself. Then Zikaron, where is the Zikaron here? In the Nevi'im. Also, Pokadati, Hashem says, I remember, that's the Haftarah for Shabbos Zohar, the war between Shaul and Agag, which did not finish things. And then the final word, Basefer, alludes to a third opening, which was then filled by the story of Esther. And really what this is highlighting for us is that the entire concept that the Megillah is a sefer is a product of the fact that it relates to the mitzvah of remembering Amalek. As if to say, what we called the first idea that we fulfill, namely to celebrate our salvation, when you think about it, that should not require reading anything from a sefer of Tanakh. In fact, we find, as the classic example, there's the mitzvah to remember our salvation on Pesach. But that does not require reading anything from the Tanakh. It doesn't even require reading from the Chumash. One simply needs to tell the story, which means that Pirsumei Nisa and telling the story doesn't have to take the form of a public kriya from a sefer with all that goes with that. That whole concept is entirely a product of the mitzvah of remembering Amalek. That needs to be Basefer, as surely as the original Zohar is from a Sefer Torah, this emanation, so to speak, of Zohar is also from a Sefer of Tanakh. And in fact, there is a further point. Megillas Esther is unlike any other Sefer in Tanakh in terms of its physical makeup. And this is discussed by the Gemara, also in Megillah, on Daf Yotes, Omid Aleph. And there the Gemara notes that the Megillah itself refers to itself by two names. On the one hand, it is called a Sefer, V'nichtav Sefer, but it's also called an Igeres, a letter. Al Kol Divrei HaIgeres Hazos. And the Gemara says, and this is the halacha, that the halachic makeup of the Megillah ultimately is a product and almost like a blend of these two characterizations. In some respects, it has the status of a sefer and the halachas of a sefer, but not in every respect. In other respects, it has the halacha of a nigeres, and the two combine. How does this manifest itself? When we look at a Megillah, probably we don't notice these things. But the Gemara says, for example, that the stitching together of the different parts, it is on parchment, of course, the stitching together of the different rolls or sections of the Megillah, it has to be with the sinew of an animal, like a sefer. One couldn't use linen thread, one couldn't use any other material, like a sefer Torah, and like tefillin, and, well, tefillin we don't have, but like a sefer Torah, and all of the other sfarim. So it's a sefer. However, says the Gemara, it does not need that stitching all the way along its spine, which a sefer Torah does, and which other sfarim does. It's enough to have three stitches if one places them strategically. That's sufficient. Why? Says the Gemara, because it's also called an igeres, a letter, and a letter doesn't need to be stitched all the way along. That's halacha for a sefer. An igeres doesn't need that. And thus we find that it is, in a sense, part Sefer, part Igeres. And what does this mean? Reb Leib Mintzberg, Zatzal, in his Sefer Ben Melech, explains that these two designations of Sefer on the one hand, a book, and Igeres, a letter, on the other, correspond to the two elements of reading the Megillah, and the two elements of this mitzvah. On the one hand, as we've seen, there is an aspect of Zohar, there's an aspect of remembering Amalek even 1,000 years later. For Amalek, you need a Sefer, and therefore the Sefer aspects of the Megillah correspond to the mitzvah of remembering Amalek in the form of Haman. But what about the Igeres? The Igeres as a letter, as information, that corresponds to spreading the word. That corresponds to telling the story. One doesn't need a sefer, a sifrei Tanakh to tell the story. An Igeres would do. And in fact, he suggests further that there's an aspect of Pirsumei Nisa that comes out from an Igeres, from a letter, because letters formed a basic part of the story. Often we find that when we wish to be mefarsim a nes, we use materials that were involved in that nes, and they then become the means through which we publicize the miracle. For example, the pirsume nisa on Hanukkah comes from lights. Why? Because the miracle happened through lights, and therefore the way through which we publicize the miracle in mitzvah form is through lights. Likewise, when it comes to Pesach, and this is already from the Torah, the miracle that we were accompanied by having to leave so quickly, and therefore the dough didn't rise and it became matzah, and therefore there becomes the mitzvah to eat matzah. All the things that were part of the miracle at the time become part of the way we tell the story. Each one with its role. And therefore, we can understand that the Megillah as a letter. And why do we read a letter? Because letters were so, but the original letters that came out, the first letters, the second letters, calling for the Jewish people's destruction, rescinding it, reframing it, rewording it, whatever it will be. And therefore that finds its way into the form in which we tell the story. And it turns out, ultimately, therefore, that the two aspects of the mitzvah of reading the Megillah, they combine to give us what you could call a hybrid type of Megillah. Part Sefer, part Igeres, because it's part Zohar, and part Persume Nisa, and that's literally within the Gashmias physical entity of the Megillah itself. So these then are the two aspects of reading the Megillah, and we do both at the same time. One could say that there are certain, perhaps, certain parts of the Megillah where one is emphasized more than the other. Quite so, but together they make up these two things. Well, anything else? Yes, there is a further element to the mitzvah of reading the Megillah. There is a further kiyum, a matter that is fulfilled through the reading, and that is based on the Gemara, also in Megillah, on Daf Yud Dalet Amud Aleph, which discusses the question of Hallel on Purim. The Gemara asks, with such an amazing salvation, surely one would expect that we should say Hallel. We say Hallel on Pesach, we say Hallel on Chanukah. Why do we not say Hallel on Purim? And the Gemara gives three answers to this question. The second of these answers is from Rav Nachman. And Rav Nachman says that in fact, we do say Hallel on Purim. It takes the form of reading the Megillah. Kriyasa Zohalela, the reading of the Megillah, is itself Hallel. And this answer is the one that's codified by the Rambam. There are other answers. The Gemara first says that one doesn't say Hallel once we've entered Eretz Yisrael. There's no Hallel for a miracle outside of Eretz Yisrael. Rava, on the other hand, says that the salvation was not complete. We're still under the thumb of Achashverosh. And in the middle there, you have Rav Nachman, and Rav Nachman says we do say Hallel in the form of the Megillah. And therefore, there is a third mitzvah, so to speak, accompanying the telling of the story is the Hallel, and it's also inbuilt into the story. There's a famous ruling of the Me'iri. I'm not sure that, as far as I know, no one actually concurs with him, but the Me'iri says that once we realize that part of the mitzvah of reading the Megillah incorporates the fulfillment of the mitzvah of Hallel, so the Me'iri says if a person should ever find himself on Purim without a Megillah and without the wherewithal to fulfill the mitzvah of reading the Megillah, she's got to say Hallel. Because with the Megillah, you don't say Hallel. If you don't have the Megillah, so you have a standing obligation of Hallel. the other authorities seem to dispute this because they understand that the form of Hallel for Purim is specifically through the Megillah. And therefore, if you have the Megillah, you fulfill Hallel. If not, so then you don't have any other options. So this then is the third idea. What's fascinating is the third idea of Hallel is probably different than the others for a simple reason. The mitzvah of Hallel as a rule only exists during the day. It only occurs during the day. Seder night is an exception, but every other day that we say Hallel, every other Yom Tov and Chanukah as well, it's only during the day, and therefore it seems, And this Mefarshim point out that even though the Rambam tells us that through the reading of the Megillah we fulfill the mitzvah of Halal, but that's specifically through the daytime reading of the Megillah. The nighttime, it's got its own mitzvahs going on. It's got the first two things. It's got Pirsumi Nissa and it's got Zohar and all of that. But Halal there isn't because there's no mitzvah of Halal by night. And in fact, there's a fascinating comment from Rabbi Tzalo Zolti, that's out there, Chief Rabbi of Yerushalayim, in the Sefer Mishnas Yavetz, because the Gemara in Megillah, again, on Daf Dalet Amud Aleph, discusses the source for the idea that we read the Megillah at night and at day. Although we take it for granted, and it's the first part of Purim that meets you, is the nighttime reading. But it's an exception, because all of the other mitzvahs, none of them apply during the night. There's no Mishloach Manos at night. On the Purim evening, there's no Matanis Lev Yonu, there's no Mishteh B'Simcha. So where does the Megillah read? We take it for granted that all of the mitzvahs, they start when Purim starts, but it's not true. Most of them don't. But Purim is unique. Where does it come from? And interestingly, the sources that are quoted in the Gemara for reading the Megillah at night do not come from the Megillah. They come from Tehillim. There's two sources, and for our purposes, we move straight to the second one. It's a pasuk that's well known, and that's the pasuk at the end of Mizmor Shir Chanukah Sabayis LeDavid. L'man yizamercha chavod v'lo yudom, Hashem Elokai le'olam odeka. There you go. That gives you reading the Megillah by day and by night. The question is, how? It doesn't talk about not day, not night, and how is this a source for anything? But Rashi explains that Lemani Zamercha Kavod. Kavod here in this pasuk refers to the soul. The Tanakh uses the term Kavod as a reference to a person's soul because it is the most honorable part of the person. Ura Kavodi, etc. and so forth. Lemani Zamercha Kavod, in order that the soul Yizamercha will sing, v'lo yudom, and won't be silent. Says Rashi, l'mani zamecha kavod, during the day. V'lo yudom, and won't be silent, during the night. But what's the difference between singing and not being silent? What happens if a person is not silent, but he's not singing? And why is one by day and one by night? Says Rav Zolti, that's exactly what we're saying. Because this opinion, the one who cites this source as the basis for reading the Megillah at night and day, it's highlighting the fact that Yizamercha, the song of the Megillah, Halal is a song, the song of the Megillah is by day. That's Leman Yizamercha Kavod. Now what about by night? Is there a song within the Megillah at night? No, because there's no Halal at night. So do we not read at all? We do. We're not silent. Velo Yidom. But that's at night. But we don't have Leman Yizamercha because that aspect of Halal is during the day. And therefore, it's quite a bit to think about, and the time of Megillah reading is not always most conducive to thinking about all these things, but the orientation going in is that there are no less than three separate ideas. Obviously, they merge together within the Megillah. Once again, Pirsumi Nisa. Number two, Zohar, to understand Amalek was still going and still going at us. And number three, at least during the day, is the mitzvah of Halal. So thus far with regards to the halachic, shall we say, underpinnings of Mikra Megillah. But I would like to move from there to discuss certain minhagim that surround the reading of the Megillah. Kirabim Hema. There are many and very different types of minhagim, and this will not account for all of them, because who can ever say that they know all of the minhagim, but certainly a good spread of them, and many of the widely practiced minhagim. And I would like to divide this discussion into three: minhagim for the Balkore, minhagim for the Balkore and the Kahal, and minhagim for the Kahal. And as we'll see, each one has their role to play. The first minhag for the Balkore, it begins even before he starts reading. Rav Haigon says that the minhag is, before the Balkore reads, he takes the Megillah, he opens it up, he spreads it out, like all over the place. And because it's like a letter. And interestingly, the Rambam elaborates, because if a person gets, it's certainly true that you see the Igeres factor come out here. Because if it's a question of reading from a Sefer, it's much more formal, much more organized. When you read a Sefer Torah, we don't open up the whole thing, even if however much you're going to read. You open the column that you're reading, and it's all very contained. A letter, you open it, it's over here, it's over there, and it's a very almost like an ostentatious or a flamboyant gesture. And the Rambam says, Laharas Hanes, in order to display the Nes, it's literally spreading the Megillah everywhere. And that further underscores that the Igeres aspect is about Persume Nissa. It's about publicizing, and therefore you want everyone to see the Megillah. It's going to be right near you if you're anywhere near the Bima. And that's the first thing. It's like spread out, ready to be read. Now, with regards to the tune of the Megillah, and as we know, the Megillah itself has a distinctive tune, but there are certain, and there's again a widespread minhag, and it goes back a number of generations, that there are certain psukim in the Megillah which are not read with the Megillah tune, and they're actually read with the Eicha tune. And there are all those psukim that describe either things that were an abuse of the Beis HaMikdash, kelim mi kelim shonim, or when the Jewish people were in dire trouble. All of those psukim, Evel Gadol LaYehudim, they're read in the Eicha tune. And although one could say that it's not really in place on Purim, although for some people they only really get into the day when they hear the Eicha tune and then something for everyone, but one could say it's not in keeping with the celebratory nature of the day, but it's actually very important, because it's very easy to really breeze by the magnitude of the miracle if we don't appreciate, even just for a moment, the danger that we were in, the extent to which one identifies with the trouble we were in is the extent to which one will rejoice over the salvation. It's very similar to what we do on Pesach, Maschilim Mignus and Misayim B'Shevach. You've got to focus for a while on the difficulties, otherwise you don't appreciate Revach V'Hatzalah and Revach Gadol Yehudim, etc. And therefore there is room, for their moment, there is room just to remember that there was trouble. I mean, that's where the miracle comes from. Other minhagim relating to the way the Baal Kori reads actually are connected to the chapter that we did last week, which is chapter 6, Balayla Hahu Nodud Ashnas HaMelech, and we mentioned, just in terms of Parshanut, it's certainly a turning point. Until now, it's either been trouble, preparing for trouble, getting into trouble, being in trouble, and trying to get out of it. But this is really where Achashverosh, she starts to think, and then Mordechai begins to ascend, Haman begins to descend, and that is why the Maharil, who is one of the pillars of recorded Minhage Ashkenaz, the Maharil says that the Baal Kori should raise his voice when he gets to Balayla Hahu, as if to say this is where things in terms of the miracle really begin to happen. And moreover, there is a further minhag, which is recorded in the minhagim of the Kehil of Frankfurt. And that is, as we mentioned again in passing, Nodud Ashnas HaMelech, and who's the Melech? And although there is a medrash which says that anytime the Megillah says Melech, it can also refer to Hashem, but the Gemara doesn't say that. The Gemara only says that on one occasion, and that's here. Nodud Ashnas HaMelech, as we said, two Dalets, Nodudah, one for Achashverosh and one for Hashem, because that's when things begin to act, and Hashem begins to act in that way, and to save the Jewish people. And that's why the minhag in Frankfurt was that the word Hamelech, the Baal Kori would say with the nigun of Hamelech for Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur. So we've mamash got like a meeting of all seasons. You've got some psukim is Eicha, and other psukim is. And this word specifically is from the Yomim Neroim. I mean, that's really everything kind of is in there. A further widespread, it's more than a minhag, because it's from the Gemara. The Gemara says in Megillah, and Daf Tetzayin Amud Beis, relates to the 10 sons of Haman. As we know, the 10 sons need to be said b'neshima achas, in one breath. And moreover, then Mefarshim had even Chamesh Mirs Ish beforehand and Aseres afterwards. It's got to be done in one breath, because they all died at the same time and apparently like at the same instant. And that's apparently such an important thing that it finds its way into the way the Megillah is read. One may have thought, well, I'm either very sorry to hear or I'm very not sorry to hear it, but either way, I'm just trying to read the Megillah. But no, because that all happened at the same instant, therefore they're all read together in that way. That's from the Gemara. Although b'diavad, as the Shulchan Aruch says, if a person didn't do it, he's certainly yotze, but that's the way it should be done. Thus far, well-known minhagim. There are certain things which perhaps are not so well-known and also subject to minhag. Maybe people don't have this minhag at all. How does one pronounce the name Mordechai? I think we're quite clear on that. We just said it's called he's called Mordechai. But actually, there is a minhag that exists in a number of kehillas that his name is not to be pronounced Mordechai with a shiva, but Mordechai with a kamatz. And Reb Shlomo Zalman Orbach said that actually, growing up in Shari Chesed, that was the way that they would pronounce his name, Mordechai. Although he says most people they do not pronounce it that way, each one should follow their minhag. But that's interesting. Even the name Mordechai itself, there are two minhagim. The final minhag for the Baal Kuri, and this one doesn't hear that much, is the Gemara says the vav of Vaizasa. And Vaizasa is, of course, child number 10, son number 10 of Haman. It should be elongated. So says the Gemara. Tzorach lemiskaveh, needs to be elongated. Aha. Now, what does that mean? Now, interestingly, there's a machlokus in Rishonim, or two opinions in Rishonim, as to whether that means, when you say the vav of Vaizasa needs to be long, do you mean in the Megillah it needs to be a long letter? Or do you mean when you read the Megillah, you need to just elongate it and give it just a moment? So instead of saying Vaizasa, you'd say V, and you'd elongate it in that way. The Shulchan Aruch says one should do both. Interestingly, the minute seems to be more about writing, because if you look in the Megillah, you'll see that the Vav of Vaizasa, the small letters there, but the Vav of Vaizasa is actually long. That's because of that Gemara. Less common is for the Baal Kuri to actually elongate the pronunciation of Vaizasa. But let's not forget, Vaizasa is number 10 of a list of 10 sons that he's been saying in one breath, which means that he's mamish got a, he has a great presence of mind. He's got to say everything in one breath, but not forget to give it just a little more time to Vaizasa. I think by that stage, well, let's just say, well, you know, one shouldn't hold one's breath for that minute. So thus far, with regards to the Baal Kuri. Now, what about the Kahal? There is a good bit of, at the risk of in any way saying it inappropriately, but there is the participation from the Kahal. Specifically, there are psukim that the Kahal says aloud, and that dates back from Rav Sadia Gaon. Rav Sadia Gaon, he mentioned two psukim, and then we showed him at another two, and as we know, they are when we meet Mordechai, and then Mordechai Yatzam Lefnei HaMelech, Laihuda Maiser B'Simcha, and then the final pasuk of the Megillah. The question is, why does the Kahal say these four psukim? Manishtan, Rav Psukim Me'ele, from all of the others. The Sefer HaEshkol, these are from Rishonim, the Sefer HaEshkol says, these are psukim of Geula. That itself, right, needs to be understood. In what way are they psukim of Geula? We introduce Mordechai. He's certainly one of the key figures of Geula. But so is Esther. Why wouldn't Esther get a pasuk held out? But Mordechai Yatzam Lefnei HaMelech, Laihuda Maisera, that's certainly psukim of Geula. The final pasuk of the Megillah just seems to be information. Obviously, it's more than that, but the Geula's already happened. But in any case, the Sefer Eshkol says, these are the four psukim of Geula, and the Kahal says them out loud. The Hagos Maimonis, again, also of the Rishonim, says that the psukim were said out loud in order to keep the children awake. So once again, it's mamish like Seder night, except you're not going to hand out treats during the Megillah. But they just be sure every once in a while that they say a pasuk out loud to make sure the children are on their toes. Quite a different explanation for why these psukim are said out loud. Le'orer hatinokos. Another pasuk that is said out loud by the Kahal, in addition to these four, and for different reasons, as we'll see, is that they say the Aseres B'nei Haman. Also, they say to help Haman's 10 sons before the Baal Kuri says Haman's 10 sons. And the question is, why? What is behind that? And here, there's a famous explanation of the Rogachev Gaon, where he says, let's not forget, everyone has a mitzvah to read the Megillah, but most people don't read it themselves. They listen to someone else reading, which is perfectly fine. He's motzi them. That's called Shomea Ka'one. And what does Shomea Ka'one mean? It means, says the Rogachev, that by listening, and he intends to be motzi you, you intend to be motzi him, through creating that link, so your listening is the equivalent of if you said the words. Okay? Very good. There's just one thing, says the Rogachev. And that is that even if this mechanism can make it the equivalent of you saying the words, but it doesn't also import the quality or other aspects of saying the words. It's just as if you said the words. Well, why is that a problem? Because as we said, there is a mitzvah to say the sons of Haman all in one breath. And what that means, therefore, is that for most of the Megillah, the Chazan's reading, and you're listening, and it's like you're reading, and it's fine. But when it comes to the 10 sons of Haman, if you only hear the Chazan say the 10 sons of Haman, he may be saying them in one breath. But when you hear it, the principle of Shomea Ka'one doesn't bring the quality of how he says it over to you. It's just the equivalent of if you said them. But you're missing the aspect of B'neshima achas, in one breath. And that's why that needs to be provided by the people themselves in order to for everyone to fulfill this idea of mentioning Haman's sons, B'neshima achas. Now, others dispute the thesis, actually, of the Rogachev, because they understand that in the same way that he could be motzi you, by listening to him, he's motzi you. So not only is it as if you've said it, or not only are you yotzi as if you said it, but it's as if you said it the way he said it, which means that if he's motzi you and he's saying it in one breath, it's like you said it in one breath. That goes across as well. Indeed, as the Chazon Ish points out, one could say it must be so, because most people don't have a kosher Megillah in front of them. They're listening to the Baal Koreh. Now, the halacha is you've got to read the Megillah from the kosher Megillah. If you read it by heart, even if you know it by heart and you recited it by heart, you're not Yotze. And if you recite it from a Chumash, which does not have the status of a Megillah, you're not Yotze. So the entire congregation, everyone who's hearing the Baal Koreh, he's reading from a Megillah, but they're listening. So if we say that Shomea Ka'one just makes it the equivalent of them talking, that's not good enough, because it's like they're saying it by heart. And therefore, clearly, the quality of reading it from a Megillah also transfers. If that's the case with regards to reading from a Megillah, so too with all other qualities. That's the argument of the Chazon Ish. So the question then is, so why does everyone say his 10 sons? Rav Moshe Sternbuch, Shalita, gives a perhaps disarmingly simple answer to this question, and that is because the Chazon, if he's saying it in one breath, it's likely, one could be prone to miss a word or whatever it will be. If there's any place in the Megillah where a person might miss something of what's happening, it's when the Chazon says that this Haman's 10 sons so quickly, and that is why each person makes sure to say it themselves, and then it's acceptable that a minority of words they say for themselves, and then they hear the rest from the Chazon. So that's a rather more balabatish, one could say, explanation as to why everyone says the 10 sons of Haman. So that's far with regards to the interplay between the Baal Koreh and the Kahal, things that they say first and he says afterwards. And what about things that the Kahal do and only the Kahal do? Specifically, the reference is to clapping Haman, banging noise, making noise when Haman's name is heard. And in fact, you see the way that the kids go to town over this, one doesn't have to worry that they'll fall asleep, and we just say Haman and everyone wakes up. So what's the background to this? So this again is sourced in Rishonim, and in fact the Beis Yosef has a very interesting conclusion here, because he quotes the Rishonim, and then the Beis Yosef says one should never be mezalzel in a minhag Yisrael, because if it has revered roots, so then one needs to give it that due reverence. The Sefer HaManhig, who's one of the Rishonim, already brings this idea of banging things together when Haman's name is mentioned in the Megillah. And the question is, why do we do this? What is it in fulfillment of, or what is it in service of? And interestingly, the Manhig quotes two possible sources for this in the Pasuk. The first, very simply, once again, Timche Secher Amalek. It's about eradicating Amalek. Okay, and Haman's from Amalek, as we know. The second is as a pasuk in Mishle, Shem Rishaim Yerkav, the name of the wicked shall rot. And therefore, once again, it's about erasing or eradicating when a Rosh's name is mentioned. And now it's important to realize that the form of this minhag, the way that it is originally presented, is quite different than what we do now as far as what I've seen. Namely, the way that it's originally described is that it took the form of writing Haman's name on wood, pieces of wood or pieces of stone or whatever it is. And then the point is, when Haman's name was mentioned, they were banged together with the intent of erasing that script from those surfaces, either from the wood or from the stone. And what's interesting is there is a medrash quoted by the Beis Yosef with regards to the pasuk, Timche es zecher Amalek, destroy or erase the memory of Amalek, says the Medrash, afilu me'al ha'itzim v'la'avonim, even from wood and from stone. And the Beis Yosef said that's really what they're doing, because they put it on wood and stone, and then they erase it. Which means the original minhag was not about making noise per se. It was taking these two things, they're banged together in order to erase the writing. That's the goal. The noise is almost like a byproduct. With the passage of time, that stopped being the case, and the noise actually became the focus, and no one really writes anything on anything anymore. And it's just that we've moved from sight to sound, and it now becomes making a ruckus, or making a noise of protest, so to speak, when Haman's name is mentioned, which could lead to sometimes lead to problems, depending, because after all, there's a value of erasing or drowning out the name of Haman, but you also have to hear every single word in the Megillah, and Haman appears quite a few times in the Megillah, and therefore there's different reactions to that and whatever it may be. A nafkimina, perhaps, as to whether the source comes from eradicating Amalek or generally, Shem Rishaim Yerkav. Russia is a much broader category than Amalek. Namely, who should one make noise for? Right? For whom the noise? And interestingly, in the Sefer Hamanig, as is quoted by the Avudraham, he actually says that this should be done when you hear the name of Haman and his sons. Which actually makes perfect sense. Because by definition, if Haman is from Amalek, his sons are also from Amalek. And therefore, if there's a concept of Timche Secher Amalek, so what everyone does for Haman should be done for his sons. But once again, that would be easier when it's about erasing the names. You can write all their names and bang together as they... But if it's about noise, and don't forget Nebuch the Balkari, he's in one breath here, and depending on how much noise is made, he may have to start from the beginning. People may never leave Shul. And therefore, that's fell into disuse a little bit, and people reserve their noise for Haman, not so much for his sons. But perhaps as a hiddur mitzvah, if a person wishes to tap lightly, at least for one for each son, so that's really the original minhag. Timche Secher Amalek, not only Haman, also his sons. What about Zeresh? Well, Zeresh, Haman's erstwhile wife, So what about her? No one really seems to make any noise for Zeresh, which one could actually say is not correct. Because after all, she's also part of the story and should be equally responded to. Let me paraphrase. Should be no vexation without representation. Well, on the one hand, we don't know if Zeresh was from Amalek. But maybe she did Haman marry out? We don't know. But she's the wife of someone from Amalek. Does that make her an honorary Amalek? But also, or dishonorary, as the case may be, but also if it's about Shem Rishoyim Yirkov, so she's a Russia, doesn't need to be a Malik anymore. There was one place that I saw, and that is in a sefer called Midrash Eliyahu, which is written by Rabbeinu Eliyahu HaKohen of Izmir, who's famous as the author of the Sefer Shevet Musar. And there he actually says to make noise for Haman, his wife, and his sons. There you have all three of them. So who knows, maybe it will catch on, but in any event. A famous ban, just have to mention for reasons that will become apparent, a famous ban on making any noise during the Haman, but took place in two places, for two different reasons. The Stechemet quotes that in his locale, they banned it because people, they didn't have Gregors in those days. Anything that they used to make noise, they would bang on the benches of Shul, and they would bang with things like hammers and axes and shovels and so on and so forth, and it could often result in grave damage to Shul property. So that's the Stechemet's complaint about what happened in his Shul. I think we have a lot to learn from the way things used to be done. But in London, also in the late 1700s, there was a ban which lasted for a good long while, clearly not until our times, but and it began in the Sephardi shul there. This is recorded in the Sefer Keter Shem Tov by someone called Rav Shem Tov Gagin, who actually lived in England in the last century, and he records that in one of the early Sephardi shuls for the Spanish and Portuguese, it's the Bevan Marks Shul. So in the late 1700s, the Gaboim of the Shul, they felt that things were getting out of hand. People made so much noise when Haman's name was mentioned, no one could hear anything, and they decided to place a ban on anyone making any noise for Haman's name, or anyone even bringing in any noise-making implement into the shul. And it was they were so serious about it, they actually contracted one of the constabulary, a London policeman, to stand at the door of the shul and make sure that no one would bring these things in. Now, some people were not happy with this, because what's Purim without making a complete awful noise? And therefore, there was one individual in particular who somehow smuggled in a hammer into the shul, and when Haman's name was mentioned, he started going, and the gabarim of the shul had him arrested, because there's a policeman outside, and he was arrested, and he was released, but they said they would only let him back into the shul if he apologized formally to the gabarim, and he refused to apologize, and he left the shul over that incident and never came back. I guess you could say he went out with a bang. And as a result of that, for a number of years, there was a takana that had to be absolute silence. And it's very interesting to hear about these things. We kind of are under the impression that the very concept of noise was created maybe like in the 60s. But already back in the day, they were contending with these issues. So these are some of the minhagim, many and varied, as surround the reading of the Megillah. And let us perhaps conclude by talking about the day itself. I mean, the days are called Yemei Mishteh V'Simcha. And what that means is although as we say there are four mitzvahs of the day, there's the reading the Megillah, Mishloach Manos, Matanos Levyonu, and the Seuda. From a certain point of view, the Seuda is the most prominent, because the characterization of the days by the Megillah itself are Yemei Mishteh V'Simcha. I mean, that's what they're called. That means that the Mishteh, which is really the way that the halacha refer, or the pasuk refers to the Seuda, it's part of the definition of the day. That's its title. And why is Mishteh such an important thing? And we note as well that it's referred to as a Mishteh, clearly coming from the word shoteh, which is drinking, and therefore that it's that type of su'udah as well. The halacha will get referred to it as su'udas purim. The pasuk, nonetheless, it presents it as a matter of mishteh. And the Abu Daram explains that the reason why the mishteh is such a central part of the of the day is because it's also, and it's once again, Zecher L'Nes. It's one of those things that it was so much part of the miracle, but then becomes part of the way we celebrate the miracle, because so much of the miracle of Purim happened through Mishteh, beginning with the first Mishteh, where Vashti was deposed, and then following through with the Mishtehs that Esther made, those two, which led to the downfall of Haman. So you have this theme, it's almost like a motif, event, of Mishteh, and that's how the miracle happened, and that's how it becomes part of the way, a central part of the way that we commemorate it and celebrate it. But there's a very important question here, simple question, and that is, when we go back to the first Mishteh, we've got to have mixed feelings about commemorating and celebrating what went on in that feast. Because as much as there's the element of Vashti was removed, and the vacancy was there, and then Esther was able to become queen for when the time was, but other things happened also at that feast, which were less worthy of celebrating, and actually best forgotten, because they were actually part of what got us into trouble in the first place. The Gemara famously identifies our attendance at the Suda of Achashverosh as one of the main causes for Haman's decree in the first place. Haman didn't come out of nowhere. The Gemara, as much as he, no one gives him any credit, and he's deserving only of punishment for his role, but we know better than just to look at him. We look behind him, as the Gemara does. And Jewish people, there are certain things that were not in order, including their attendance in that feast and their conduct at that feast. And therefore, why is that something that we wish to bring into our celebration? That's an important question. And the answer is, our feast is not just a commemoration of that feast, but rather it is a rectification of that feast. It's not just that we remember, but we're actually doing right what we did wrong at that time. It is an active part of rectifying what went wrong. How so? Well, to understand how we're rectifying what went wrong, we need to ask a more basic question: what went wrong? What was so objectionable? Now, of course, there's men. Where does one start? But the truth is that all the things that we could say, and they're all true, but then maybe the food wasn't kosher, or maybe just the ambience wasn't kosher, and other things were going on, that may well be. But all of this needs to add up to, therefore the Jewish people were liable for Haman to level a decree for their annihilation. It's good. The crime has to answer to that result. And no one takes the non-kosher food lightly, but it doesn't give you a result like that. And that's where Rabbi Yonasan Eibeshit says something else. This feast, it wasn't just, and again, we're speaking carefully, it wasn't just about this or that problem of non-kosher food, etc. and so forth. It was something else. As we know, Achashverosh here had made a reckoning. It was known, the Jewish people, they're in exile for 70 years, but then they'll be remembered, and then they'll keep going, and then they'll go back. And 70 years, by his reckoning, came and went. And that's why he made his feast. That means that Achashverosh's feast was essentially celebrating the dissolution of the Jewish people. They are no more, as a going concern, which was to the relief of anyone who was irked by their existence, or they, so there's no such thing as the Jewish people anymore, and that was cause for celebration. What does it mean now for the Jewish people to attend that feast? It represents, and it's very, very difficult to say, but that's why the consequences were so dire. It represents essentially identifying with an abdication of their status as a Jewish people, which means that they were okay to be on the celebrating side, even though it was about their own demise. Because that's the Jewish people. They're not Jewish people anymore. They're the Persian people, or the newest group of Persian people. To take part in a celebration of the termination of the concept called Israel was already serious enough for what came through Haman. And moreover, what did the Jewish people learn? They cannot dissolve that easily. And if they try, someone will notice them, and it won't be that easy. And there's a reason why, because the Jewish people have a role in history. And the message of the Megillah, therefore, is essentially, is Netzach Yisrael, that the Jewish people are never terminated, the Jewish people are never history. And therefore, when we consider the Seuda, the celebratory feast of the Jewish people on Purim, it really is an amazing counterpoint to the Feast of Achashverosh. Because the Feast of Achashverosh says the Jewish people are no more. And every year, the Jewish people, you'll never see them happier than on Purim. And what are they celebrating? Netzach Yisrael. They're celebrating the eternity of the Jewish people. And that's a rectification of what they were prepared to say at Achashverosh's feast. Every year, the Jewish people get together and they proclaim, one can paraphrase, rumors of our termination have been greatly exaggerated. And that's why it's a tikkun. And that's why the story of Purim, it essentially instills within the consciousness of the Jewish people a sense of their own eternity, and that gives really then encouragement. Whatever state the Jewish people should find themselves in, they know that they'll get out of it because that's Israel eternal. And that's why we say about Purim, Chuasa Ma'isa Lanetzach, that salvation was Lanetzach, was in order to inculcate within the Jewish people a sense of their own eternity, which leads to V'tikvasam B'chol Dovar Dor. That gives them hope in every generation, because as dire as things got, and things have gotten dire again, as we said, Amalek is not out yet, but in B'chol Dor V'Dor, there's always hope, because the Jewish people, as HaKadosh Baruch Hu's people, will always be there. So this is really what's being celebrated, and certainly due course for celebration, Ish Ish Kedarko, and we continue celebrating Netzach Yisrael, we continue in each and every generation with Tikvasam B'chol Dor V'Dor, in the hope that those hopes will be realized. B'mehir B'yameinu L'Gaula Shelema.